Support for the World's Podcast comes from Goldman Sachs. To learn about developments currently shaping markets, industries, and the global economy, subscribe to the firm's podcast, Exchanges at Goldman Sachs, available on iTunes and Stitcher.
Who's behind Darth Putin's mask today on The World? I'm Marco Werman. There is a parody Twitter account that the Kremlin does not like. It's called @DarthPutinKGB, and no one knows who's running it.
It's clearly somebody who's very clever. It's clearly somebody that knows a lot about Russia. And it's clearly somebody that's very tech savvy.
Also, an Iranian-American comedian who grew up in California thinking she was kind of Mexican.
I knew that I wasn't Mexican, but they felt sort of like the closest minority group to what I was. And so at the time, I was just sort of like, eh, close enough.
Plus how a meteorite helped create King Tut's dagger.
They've probably found the source of the meteor that provided the material for the dagger, which is an oasis about 90 miles west of Alexandria called Kharga.
That and more today on The World. Thank you for being with us, and may the force be with you. I'm actually going to change that line for our first story today. May the farce be with you. I'm referring to a Twitter account called @DarthPutinKGB. Here's a sample tweet. I don't watch Game of Thrones. I won it. Like I said, farce. But the Kremlin's usually not big on farce, not when it's about Putin anyway. Darth Putin KGB went dark on Tuesday. Twitter did not give a reason why, but followers complained of censorship, and now Darth Putin KGB is back. Brian Whitmore has been covering the story for Radio Free Europe.
Darth Putin KGB is a parody site, and he basically is in character all the time. He's pretending to be Vladimir Putin using humor that it's unimaginable for the real Vladimir Putin. So there's no way to mistake him for the real thing. For example, when the Panama Papers scandal broke, he tweeted, I may just now have to annex Panama. when the Ukrainian military pilot Nadia Savchenko, who was essentially kidnapped from Ukraine and brought to Russia, was sentenced to 22 years in prison, he tweeted, "It appears that Savchenko has been sentenced to one presidential term." This is the spirit he's always tweeting in. He'll threaten to serve you tea. Which is an obvious reference to the assassination of Alexander Litvinenko, the defector in London.
Right.
So it goes on all day. He's reacting to the news. It's very current and people follow it. I mean, before the account was suspended, he had 58,000 followers. Now he has over 60,000.
You say he. Do we know who is running at Darth Putin KGB?
We don't know it. We don't know who is running Darth Putin KGB. It's clearly somebody who's very clever. It's clearly somebody that knows a lot about Russia. It's clearly somebody with a very, very good sense of humor. And it's clearly somebody that's very tech savvy.
So the account was suspended and now it's back up again. But first, why do you think it was suspended?
I have my suspicions. I don't know for sure.
Yeah.
But my suspicions are that it was an orchestrated campaign by pro-Russian trolls. And I'm not alone in sharing that suspicion.
Mm. What leads you to that?
Well, we know these trolls are out there and they're very active. They're attacking me constantly, and I'm sure they don't like him. These are not just random people either. They're entire, what they call troll factories in Russia that crank out these people. They're paid to do these kinds of things on the internet to attack anybody writing about Russia that takes a line the Kremlin doesn't like in any language. I mean, they're operating in English and German and Finnish and Czech. They're all over the place. But one of the things they do is try to get people like this banned. And I think it's worth noting that before Darth Putin KGB was suspended, a series of parody accounts were suspended. Soviet Sergei, for example, an account that parodies the Russian foreign minister, Sergei Lavrov, was just about a week before Darth Putin was suspended. This account was suspended. Another account called Not Russia was suspended. This was part of a trend. Now, the encouraging thing is now this trend is being reversed because a lot of these accounts have been restored. I mean, if you look at Twitter's rules on a parody accounts, you cannot be actually leading people to believe you are actually that person. Well, anybody who has an account, if their intro says 140% of the Russian people did not elect me, I think it's reasonable for any normal person to not think that that is actually Vladimir Putin, you know, tweeting these things.
I have to ask you, Brian, where do we actually see allusions to Darth Vader in his account, or is it just the whole kind of dark force vibe?
that's just the Dark Force vibe. I don't think there's any allusions to Darth Vader there, other than in the name.
Well, maybe one day we can get at Darth Putin KGB to meet at Kim Jong Number Un.
That could be
a really interesting gathering. Brian Whitmore is senior Russia analyst for Radio Free Europe in Prague. Thanks very much, Brian.
Thanks for having me.
Russia plays a big role in our next story as well. In March of 2014, Russian forces annexed the Crimean Peninsula from Ukraine. President Putin then went on to back a separatist movement in eastern Ukraine. Both events have faded from the headlines, but they've permanently changed life for many in Ukraine, particularly for the estimated 1.7 million people displaced by the changes. From Kyiv, Julia Barton has our story.
On a recent Saturday in Kyiv, children pack a room at the end of a long corridor in a huge Soviet-era building. The kids sit cross-legged on the floor or sprawl out on giant stuffed animals. They're all drawing. This is a weekly club for kids displaced from eastern Ukraine. While the kids are doing art today, many of their parents are across the street at a volunteer center that was set up when refugees started appearing in Kyiv more than 2 years ago. Victoria Vasilyevskaya came here from the eastern city of Lugansk with her husband and three children. We didn't need anyone to tell us that things were getting dangerous and we needed to take our kids and go, she says. Vasilyevskaya and others were welcomed with open arms in those early days. Volunteers set up the center to handle the avalanche of donated food and clothing. Vasilyevskaya says this place became her lifeline. I never get this here, she says, imitating a judgmental sideways glance. People feel at home here. You get kind words. And you understand that you're not alone. Even in a big city where you don't have family or friends, you're not alone. Now, Vasilyevskaya has become a volunteer herself. And there's so much work to be done, even though the immediate crisis has passed for most of the displaced. Moving to a new city is not easy in Ukraine. Here, extended families take care of children, and personal networks help people find jobs. Ukraine's government has finally set up a ministry to handle the displacement crisis, but it's just getting organized. And the task of helping some groups is huge, especially the ragtag army of volunteers who fought on the Eastern Front and have come here with physical and psychological wounds. I meet Alexei Morozov in a cafe in a military hospital. He's seeing a doctor for a head injury from a battle in the summer of 2014. Morozov had been a mechanic in the eastern city of Donetsk when the fighting began. He decided to join a pro-Ukrainian volunteer battalion, even though he's HIV positive. After a couple of months fighting, Morozov's group was captured. He says they lived more than a month in a police basement. The lights were never turned off, and they were beaten, he says.
There's no law there. There's only the law of the strongest. Whoever has the machine gun rules.
Worse, Morozov says, he was denied his antiretroviral medication for HIV. Finally, he was put in a work camp where his wife could smuggle him medicine. He was released in a prisoner swap 2 months later. Now Morozov tries to help other displaced veterans get assistance, but he says it hasn't been easy.
The government should provide all of this. We shouldn't have to ask them. They should be providing help.
Back at the volunteer center in Kyiv, people like Victoria Vasilyevskaya aren't waiting for help. They're bagging up donations to send to other parts of Ukraine, where the displaced get less aid. Vasilyevskaya has been so outspoken in support of a unified Ukraine, she feared going back to Lugansk last year for her own mother's funeral. Despite all that, she's philosophical about the crisis that brought her family to Kyiv. There's a future here, she says. If it had to happen this way, well, maybe it's for the better. As for when she'd return to Lugansk and the empty apartment she still owns there, only when it's all Ukraine again, she says. For The World, Julia Barton, Kyiv.
Julia's story is supported by the Pulitzer Center on Crisis Reporting. Photojournalist Misha Friedman reported alongside Julia. Misha spent 2 years documenting internally displaced people who are also living with HIV, and his photos tell a heart-wrenching story. See for yourself at PRI.org. Have you caught any of these crazy headlines flying around social media today, like King Tut's cosmic dagger or perhaps extraterrestrial artifact found in mummy's tomb? Well, there's actually a real story here, and to find out more, I'm calling in some expert help. No, not Indiana Jones, although it is almost 35 years since Raiders of the Lost Ark came out. I'm talking about our resident history buff, Chris Wolfe. What is the cosmic artifact, Chris?
Well, it's a knife or a dagger, Marco, that was buried with King Tutankhamun, the boy king of ancient Egypt. And, you know, I don't know if you had a chance to skim through some of the blogs and tweets and the superficial reporting on this, and you'd think they'd found some kind of cosmic dagger that like fell from space or was hand-delivered by extraterrestrials. You know, they leave you wondering, these headlines, maybe this is some kind of magical artifact that, you know, could endow the ancient Egyptians with the power to conquer all the huge empire that they did. But happily, the truth is much more interesting.
Yeah, I noticed you said superficial reporting there. So what is the truth?
Well, what scientists have done is prove with a high level of confidence that this iron dagger, which was actually found by the cursed team of Howard Carter themselves in 1925, wrapped around King Tut's right thigh, it's actually made from iron from a meteorite. And the findings are published in the scientific journal Meteoritics and Planetary Science. But this is not as much of a breakthrough as you'd think. It does overturn the findings of another test in the 1990s. But no one should be surprised that ancient Egypt used meteoritic iron.
Why? I mean, I find that pretty fascinating. Iron from meteors for a dagger?
Well, Marco, this is the Bronze Age. We haven't quite got to the Iron Age yet. So humanity simply hadn't figured out how to smelt iron ore. There's huge deposits of iron ore in what was ancient Egypt, but there's almost no evidence of smelting taking place. However, there are dozens of these iron artifacts, and the reason is it's because they were working with iron from meteors for about 2,000 years before that. But you've got to remember, this is more rare and more precious than gold at the time. It was more valuable than gold. So that's why you only find it in these ceremonial, ritual, high-value artifacts like the things that get buried with King Tut. He had one of iron and one of gold, each of these daggers. And here's a Game of Thrones reference for you that people might like if they're fans of the show.
Tell
is
us.
That the ancient Hittites, obviously, iron was more precious than gold, so they built an iron throne.
Wow. All right. What is the difference between iron ore on Earth and, say, this iron from meteors?
Well, the key thing that makes it useful is that it's already iron. It's not like iron ore is basically like a rock that you have to crush and melt down at extremely high temperatures to get anything useful out of it. But iron that comes from a meteor is pretty much ready to go.
I mean, pretty fascinating. A dagger that has its origins in a meteorite. What else does the study show, though?
Well, they've probably found the source of the meteor that provided the material for the dagger, which is an oasis about 90 miles west of Alexandria called Khaga. They can tell because iron from a meteor has a high nickel content, and the amount in the knife matches pretty roughly the meteor. The other thing it shows you is how, despite its rarity, the surprisingly excellent quality of ironsmithing in ancient Egypt, even though it's a very scarce material. And then the other thing is that the Egyptians, the study shows, Egyptians understood where it came from because of a special word for iron, that hieroglyph that emerges in the 13th century before the Common Era. It literally means metal from the sky.
So they understood that the source of their iron was outer space.
Exactly. And thousands of years before Europeans figured out that this was a potential source of iron as well.
The world's one-man history desk, Chris Wolfe, thank you.
You're welcome, Marco.
Still to come on the show, strikes and floods in France spell bad news for soccer fans and wine. Find out why later here on The World. Feeling like you belong, that can be tough at any age, but the struggle to fit in high school, well, that's a whole nother level of trying to belong. In her new book, How to Make White People Laugh, Iranian-American comic Nagin Farsad chronicles her efforts to do just that. In Palm Springs, California, she says she just wanted to hang out with the Mexican kids. And when her only Iranian-American classmate started dating a Mexican girl, Farsad saw firsthand how explosive racial identity can be.
everyone was just like, this can't be happening, you know. And she was a part of the ESL, the English as a Second Language program, a new immigrant. And the other Iranian kid in my high school, he was in the AP programs, and he was like a smarty pants. And it just was sort of like, this is a socioeconomic clash. This is an ethnic clash. But to me, it sort of really made sense, because it was like, both of your parents, you know, don't speak English very well. You go home and eat different foods. You go home and have a different relationship with religion. And that sort of is harmonious. So I thought that relationship really made sense, but it was a big scandal at Palm Springs High School.
I went to school down south, and I was always kind of amazed at how groups just self-segregated. Mm. When you started seeing this, I assume you did. What did you make of it?
Well, I just felt like as an Iranian-American muzz, I just didn't know which group to also segregate into. I think that's kind of what ends up happening, you know. And in college, there were no Mexicans, you know, as far as the eye could see, which is the group that sort of made me feel at home. And I ended up becoming, you know, kind of, that's when my Black formation really began. You know, I started really like studying the canon of Black film and really getting into Black culture and Black politics. And I ended up, like most comedians, getting a master's degree in African American studies. And so I really, you know, kind of went, and I still do, and I still will fight for those rights whenever I can. But at a certain point, this was the aftermath of 9/11, you know, people were like, don't you have your own people? And I was just like, how could you say that? I have the DVD box set of A Different World in my backpack. You know, I am committed. But at a certain point, you know, I did have my own people. And with Islamophobia on the rise, which it's been sort of steadily on the rise since then, I realized that I could have a voice that was helpful.
You actually kind of got a deep dive into the sorority fraternity scene in college. Given how white that was, what was that like for you?
I sort of likened it to being like the straight coat check girl at a gay bar. Like, you're just sort of totally invisible when you're a person of color in the Greek system. And I wasn't in the Greek system. I just like, you know, I just dipped my toes in, you know, by going to frat parties and just being like, hey, I'm here. Like, I'm ethnic, and I'm going through a strange goth phase / gypsy phase. And I was really just trying to kind of figure out where I belonged. And it wasn't at frat parties.
Mm. You describe a time when you're doing a show and a group of Muslim women seated together wearing hijabs. They get up and they walk out because they consider your material shameful. Mm. Iranian women and another audience label you a whore.
Yeah.
How painful is all this?
I mean, I'm not going to lie. Like, I'm, you know, I mean, I am a comedian, so in some ways I'm dead inside. But also, I do, like, you know, still activate the feelings. And I performed in Tucson, Arizona. And like you said, a group of hijabi women got up and left during my set. And you know, it was 400 people in that theater. And when these, like, 20 or 30 women got up and left, it was a big show. It was a big statement. And they wanted to hurt me, you know. And I was hurt by it. And it's that kind of thing really sucks. I'm not going to lie. But I think what I've been able to do is now talk about it. You know, that scene kind of that made it into my last film, The Muslims Are Coming, and it made it into my book. And I think it's sort of giving us all a chance to reflect on how we're treating each other, like within the Muslim community, as well as how we are being treated as Muslims.
I wanted to ask you about the word muzz. You use it a lot in your book. You're a muzz.
It's just a shorthand, fun way. I think we actually never think of Muslims as fun, and we don't think of the word as fun. And I'm trying to just subtly change that by just using some slang to talk about the muzz thing.
Registered trademark from Nagin Farsad. Years after college, you reconnected at a bar with your blonde, uber-popular college roommate. You call her Molly in the book. Mm. And she's pretty upset about how she had treated you in college. And she's crying because, as you put it in your book, her freshman self didn't understand that there was a real difference between us, or what it felt like to never question belonging. So what happened in that visit with Molly?
Molly was, like, wonderful. You know, she was a really great friend, but she was always, like, she was the one that was, like, trying to get me to these frat parties and putting me in situations where I wasn't accepted, and she didn't understand that I wasn't accepted. And it took her 10 years to realize what she had grown up with, this kind of easy acceptance and popularity and blonde beauty and all of that stuff. And so, you know, it was interesting. And she cried. She cried in front of me. She thought, I didn't understand what some of the people of color around me were going through because I was just, like, busy. I was going, you know, pledging a sorority, and I was having the time. And I didn't realize that you guys weren't.
Speaking of guilt, you went on a visit to Iran some years ago, back to the homeland, and you grappled with what you call guilt, guilt that you have the American dollar to fall back on, guilt knowing that you could go home and wear what you want when you get there.
Yeah.
Tell us about that and how you came to terms with that guilt.
My cousin was getting married, and we were the same age, and I thought, like, oh, I can't talk about, you know, boys or alcohol or peaceable assembly, you know, these freedoms we have in the United States. And I felt like, how could they be happy? They don't have any of these freedoms. And so that was really tough for me. But being in Iran and being around the kind of community that they have and the family units that they build for each other, they have, I think, more fun than the average American because they really cherish the little things then. The little freedoms that they have, they cherish them so much. You know, I ended up, while in Iran, also breaking a toilet by sitting on it. Side note, I sat on a toilet that was made of porcelain, and I cracked it open in half by the sheer force of just me sitting on it. So that's something that I always can take to my grave, knowing that I broke a toilet in Iran.
It was a toilet. You're a relatively small stature, let's face it. Right?
The toilet had seen better days, but I didn't think I was going to be the one to break it.
How guilty did you feel about that?
Yeah, you don't know what it's like to walk down the stairs of your aunt's house carrying a piece of porcelain and saying to her, I broke the toilet. And then she said, oh, that flush never works. And I said, no. And I held up a piece of porcelain. I said, I really literally broke a toilet. So there you go.
Iranian-American stand-up comedian Nagin Farsad's new book is called How to Make White People Laugh. I was laughing out loud while I read it. I even laughed at the author bio on the back.
Oh, good.
Nagin, thanks so much.
Thanks so much for having me.
There was so much more to our interview, so we posted the extended version on our Twitter. You can hear Nagin talk about feeling black, passing as white, and how eating a bag of Cheetos sometimes helped clear up her confusion about her identity. Just look for PRI's The World on Twitter. You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. A Brit was shopping online recently when he noticed something special up for sale.
He saw this advert on eBay for what was advertised as a German telegram machine.
Turns out it was a whole lot more than that. A rare Nazi encoding machine winds up in an English garden shed. That story's ahead here on The World.
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from TIAA. Whether it's investing, advice, banking, or retirement, TIAA is committed to helping those who do good do well. You can learn more at TIAA.org.
I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. The scenes of devastation in southeast Texas are tough to take. Drenching rains have caused massive flooding and a number of deaths. Outside of Houston, the Brazos River surged to its highest level in more than a century yesterday. Parts of Europe, too, have also been hit hard by flooding this week. Rivers bursting their banks, subways closed, people trapped in homes and cars. Adeline Sia joins me from Burgundy in France. Adele, what is it like where you are?
Well, I think I'll never complain about Boston's spring showers again. You know, it's been just raining nonstop here for days, and the weather has been nothing if extreme. So apparently in 150 years history, nothing has even come close to this level of precipitation. It's kind of doomsday-like. So here in the past month in Burgundy, we've had a couple of hailstorms. Some of it was like golf ball sized, and it destroyed crops and vineyards. More specifically, this is Burgundy, and around the villages of Irancy and Chablis, which is probably one of the best known place for wine production in France. Some winemakers say they simply won't be able to produce wine at all in 2016.
Well, the rain isn't the only thing bringing things to a halt in France. You've had a lot of strikes in the past few weeks, right? What exactly has been affected?
Transportation has been very spotty. Railway network SNCF is on its second day of strike this week. They went on strike last week as well. I looked online today to see if I could even get a train to Paris, and basically I got an answer that was, we don't even understand what you're asking. There were just no trains. No trains to be had, period.
I know France is kind of a strike-prone country, but what are these strikes about?
It's got to do with the notorious labor reform law that would give employers more leeway with their staff. So whether it comes to hire and fire employees, extend working hours, reduce pay, and that's completely unacceptable to some workers' unions who have demanded a complete withdrawal of the current law. But in spite of changes to the law since the protests began, there have been demonstrations everywhere across France, and some of them, as I'm sure you know, have turned fiery and violent. So we're not out of the woods yet with that.
I know there was a gas shortage that got pretty bad last week. Are the strikes causing any problems in that whole field? I mean, long lines for gas?
Yes, long lines, because when people heard that the oil refineries were closed down, everybody ran in a panic to the gas stations, even though there was not really a problem. It was just more fear of a problem, which in fact did cause the problem. I was a culprit myself. I felt like I had to get in line to fill the tank of my car, even though I have a hybrid and I had no business going there. But I just wanted to see what it was all about. And I guess I had a lot of time to talk to people in line, you know, in their cars about the strikes. And in fact, I was surprised to hear that many of them really support the workers on strike. In fact, 70% of French people are against this labor law reform in its current shape, because most people do feel like reform is needed.
Pretty tense backdrop for the upcoming Euro 2016 soccer championships. That's going to be in France. I mean, how's this all going to play out next week when this starts up? You've got transportation, energy strikes.
Imagine transportation strikes during this month-long prestigious Euro 2016 championship. We're expecting 2.5 million soccer fans here in stadiums and 7 million in fan zones across the country. On top of that, the U.S. State Department issued a European travel warning this week, stating that these stadiums and fan zones, as if nobody noticed, make easy targets for terrorists. So there's been a lot of pressure on the government to put security measures in place for this event. The government says those measures are unprecedented. I mean, 10,000 security guards and video surveillance, bag searches, bomb squads on standby and so on. One more thing to consider, tourism has been down in France, especially in Paris, since the November attacks. So right. The last thing that businesses need now is strikes that may cause cancellation or just major frustrations among fans.
Never a dull moment, as you say. Adeline Sia speaking with us from a rainy Burgundy in France. Thanks for your time, Adele.
You're welcome, Marco.
Another story for you now about work and workers' rights. In Lebanon, it's common for families to have live-in help. The vast majority of these workers are women from Africa and Southeast Asia. They work long hours to send money back home to support their families. It's an exhausting life, and local labor laws don't protect them. So now some of these domestic workers are banding together to create what might be the first domestic workers' union in the entire region. The World's Richard Hall has a story from Beirut.
Rosie Mai Limbu came here from Nepal in 2003, and for the next 4.5 years, she barely went outside.
And my madam, she afraid to let me go out. So 4.5 years, I was inside the house. I have no day off, nothing. If she wants to go to the church, she took me. So that time only I can see some outside world. Otherwise, no, inside the house, to stay with one old lady.
4 years? 4.5 years?
4.5 years.
I asked Mai Limbu if she ever felt like she could just walk out.
That time, you know, I feel I have fear, you know, inside. If I go outside, this is not my country, you know. That time, I was very young. I came here when I was 19 years old. So I didn't get courage to do such kind of things.
Mai Limbu is now 31 years old. She's just one of the roughly 250,000 women who have come to Lebanon to work as maids, nannies and caregivers. Many of them face exploitation and abuse.
There isn't much that they can do, unfortunately.
Nayel Rahi works for a women's rights group here called Kafa, which means enough. She says the abuse is rooted in the kafala, or sponsorship system. When migrant domestic workers arrive in Lebanon, they have to hand over their passport to their employer. And from that moment on, they lose control of their lives.
The woman, the worker, is usually tied to one employer. And this is the name of this employer that is on her residency permit and on her work permits, which means that the worker is under total subordination of the employer, and the employer usually controls all the aspects of the life of this worker, from her arrival to Lebanon, to her livelihood, to how many hours she works, to her leaving the country.
And if they're mistreated by their employer, they have little recourse. Current labor laws in Lebanon don't cover migrants, so they have no legal rights. Even if someone escapes from her employer and seeks help from the police often just bring her back. This is a cell phone video posted on YouTube in 2012. It shows an Ethiopian woman named Alam Dishaza. She's being dragged through the street by her employer, crying and pleading for help. She's bundled into a car and then taken to hospital, where she hanged herself with strips of bedding. When the video was shown on Lebanese TV, it was shocking for many here. But El Rahi wasn't entirely surprised.
Sometimes there are some moments in time where it has been at a rate of one suicide per week. It's frequent because of the lack of options that these women have.
There are signs, though, that things are beginning to change. This is the sound of the domestic workers of Beirut on the march. One of them is a vet from Cameroon.
I'm marching today because we need our liberty. We are tired of suffering in Lebanon, and we need our freedom, we need our passport with us. So that is why we are contesting today for this march, because we want the Lebanese to know also that we are human beings. We are people's children. They should stop treating us like animals.
After years of asking for help from authorities, these women have taken matters into their own hands. They've started their own union specifically for domestic workers, believed to be the first of its kind in the Middle East. I went along to one of their recent meetings. The union offers English classes, computer lessons, and most importantly, it's a place where these women can come for support. They're still campaigning for official recognition from the government, but they're also pressing for an end to the kafala system and a law guaranteeing rights for migrant workers in Lebanon. One of the leaders here is Rosie Maya Limbu, the woman who was kept inside for years. She now goes to union meetings every Sunday.
It's very important for not only for me, it's important for all the workers, because all the workers need freedom, good salary, and they have their social life.
For Maya Limbu, it was other domestic workers who helped her break free. Her friends talked to her employer and persuaded her to give Maya Limbu a day off once a week. Now she spends that day here at the union, trying to do the same for others. For The World, Richard Hall, Beirut.
You remember the film The Imitation Game? It told the story of the Enigma machine. The Nazis used it to send coded messages during World War II, and the Brits managed to crack it. But the Germans had another cipher, vastly more complicated, which they used to send high-level strategic messages between Nazi commanders and Hitler himself. This was the Lorenz machine. They're extremely rare today, but a teleprinter from one of the machines recently popped up for sale on eBay. The price? $14. A volunteer from the National Museum of Computing in England at the famous Bletchley Park spotted the device and snapped it up. It'll go on display tomorrow in a special ceremony. The museum's John Wetter went with a colleague to collect the machine. A woman at the address told them it was inside her garden shed.
So we went down to the bottom of the garden, opened the shed door, and she rummaged around and took away polythene bags and sacks and things, and buried underneath all that lot was this Lorenz teleprinter. She said, oh, I hope you can carry it to the car because it's quite heavy. So we humped it to the car. And just before we went, I said, how did you actually come by this machine? And she said, an elderly neighbour passed away, a gentleman. The family asked us if we've managed to help them with the house clearance. And she said, amongst the bits and pieces in the house clearance, they said to us, well, look, this old box of tricks isn't any use. So do you want it or do we take it down to the tip?
Mm.
So they acquired it, and how long it had been in their shed, we've no idea.
So it didn't mean too much to those people, but to you, it meant a lot. How long have you been trying to put together the bits of the Lorenz cipher, and how significant is this find of this teleprinter?
To us, it's extremely significant, because when we got it back to the museum at Bletchley Park, we cleaned it up, and we recognised then it was a military version of the machine. You could tell that because there was a plate on the chassis which carried the German swastika and eagle, plus the German military code number for the machine. It was manufactured in 1943. So we knew from that moment that we got a German military machine which could well have been used with the Lorenz SZ-42 encryption machine.
Just give us a little background on the Lorenz machine. Just how complex was it compared to the Enigma machine, given that it was sending messages at the high levels of the Third Reich Command? How important was it to the Nazis?
Extremely important. It was the highest level of intelligence. To that end, they specially commissioned the Lorenz company in Germany to design and produce a teleprinter encryption machine, which, to use their words, would produce an unbreakable cipher. And it is extremely complicated. It's probably 100 times more complex than Enigma. It's got 12 rotors on this machine, and each message was uniquely encrypted. And to give you an idea of the complexity which the people at Bletchley Park had to do in wartime, the number of combinations of wheel start positions is 1.6 million billion.
Wow. 1.6 million billion.
Yeah, 1.6 million billion. That's British billion.
The efforts at Bletchley Park to crack the Enigma device, were they also working on cracking the Lorenz machine?
There were two separate parts of Bletchley Park in wartime. One which was devoted to cracking Enigma, which most people know about. And there's another section of Bletchley Park which was devoted to cracking the Lorenz cipher.
What was more important to ending the war, cracking the Lorenz cipher or Enigma?
I would say they both played an extremely important part, and I wouldn't like to give either of them points out of 10 in terms of their contribution. All you can say is that the combined contribution of both of them saved hundreds of thousands of lives and arguably shortened the war by 1 or 2 years. But you can make your own judgment, because we're talking now about that if you're cracking the Lorenz cipher, that's reading the messages between the strategic command messages between Berlin and the field commanders. So it's the highest value of military intelligence you can possibly get.
And for the Lorenz machine, I know you've got most of the pieces. Tomorrow, for the veterans who will attend the ceremony, will they be able to see it demoed?
Yes. For the first time, we're now, because of what I've just told you, we're able to demonstrate how the Germans used the equipment in wartime. We've got six veterans, five ladies and one gentleman, who actually worked on cracking the Lorenz cipher in wartime. We've got the relatives of very important people who worked there, namely Bill Tutt, who was the guy who managed to work out the logical structure of the Lorenz encryption machine without ever having seen one until the war ended. And that was accredited after the war had ended as most intellectual feat of World War II. We've also got relatives of Tommy Flowers, who he and his team produced the Colossus computer, which played a vital part in getting the wheel settings that you need to decrypt the message. So it's going to be a fascinating event tomorrow and enable those people to see eventually both sides, what we call both sides of the equation, i.e. how the Germans use the equipment in wartime and also how we managed to decrypt those signals during World War II.
Yeah, a fascinating event and possibly somewhat emotional for the people attending.
Oh, very. I mean, I've seen some of them before. They're lovely people, very sociable, and it's fascinating to hear what they say and to listen to them telling you of their experiences in wartime. Absolutely fascinating.
John Wetter with the National Museum of Computing at Bletchley Park in Great Britain. Thank you very much, John.
You're very welcome. Thank you.
I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. If you're like me, you've got a junk problem. All over my house, I keep finding old cell phones, smartphones, laptops that died, cartridges for a printer that stopped working, about 5 years ago. The number of these things in our lives, and I haven't even mentioned step counters and HDTVs, has exploded. And their life cycles seem to get shorter and shorter, which means a lot more electronic waste. So what happens to all of that junk? Well, a lot of it ends up overseas in illegal dumps and unregulated recycling shops. The problem's gotten so much attention that many American companies have pledged to help stop the export of e-waste. But a new investigation suggests that the problem hasn't gone away. Here's reporter Ken Christensen from our partners at the public media collaboration Earthfix in Seattle.
You might have seen one of these kinds of ads online or on TV.
In the United States alone, consumers have stockpiled an estimated 3 billion pounds of old computers and electronics at home.
Consumer electronics make up the fastest growing source of waste on the planet, and the U.S. is the single largest producer of electronic waste. Not long ago, much of this stuff wasn't safely recycled, and a lot of it ended up in toxic dumps in the developing world. These days, though, much of the industry is promising a new day in recycling.
Simply pack it into the car with other household donations and drop it off at a participating Goodwill location. Whatever parts cannot be reused or refurbished will be broken down securely and recycled responsibly.
That term, recycled responsibly, often isn't defined, but it's widely understood to mean here in the U.S. And recent studies have suggested that exports aren't a big problem anymore. But Jim Puckett wasn't convinced.
Most of the public still thinks that if they're going to recycle it right there in America, they have the right to know where their stuff goes.
Puckett's the founder of the Basel Action Network. It's a watchdog group that monitors compliance with a global hazardous waste dumping treaty called the Basel Convention. Puckett's been investigating the afterlife of electronic waste for nearly two decades. Recently, his team put GPS trackers in 200 old computers, printers, and TVs, dropped them off at recycling and take-back programs across the U.S., and watched where they ended up. Most of the devices were disposed of in the U.S. That's the good news. The bad news? About a third of them were shipped out of the country, including to places like this.
There it is.
Puckett's in a van in the outskirts of Hong Kong, using an iPad app to track a little orange marker.
Yep. Let me just, stop, and I'll just look through the fence.
The van pulls up to a series of high metal fences. Puckett gets out and peeks through a crack.
Oh my God, it's quite a scene.
He says there's about 30 people smashing up a mountain of printers.
We gotta get in there.
Losai! Losai!
Puckett's translator Dong Shasu tells a man on the other side of the fence that they want to buy old printers. The door opens onto a dirt lot filled with 15-foot-high piles of printers. Workers are using power drills to dismantle them. They're not wearing face masks. Their aprons are caked with black printer dust, a possible carcinogen. Workstations are littered with broken fluorescent tubes from old LCD screens, which Puckett says release mercury vapor.
One of the more toxic metals known.
Sue asks a worker if he knows about the risks.
He has no idea. They don't know if it's dangerous for them.
In the U.S., electronics recycling workers wear protective gear when they extract the most toxic components. Parts containing mercury, lead, and other hazardous materials are processed carefully, and almost all of the materials get reused. That's not always true in Hong Kong. Puckett tracked another device here, to a lot that's abandoned, but for a few guard dogs.
What have we got over here?
He tromps through tall grass in a nearby field and pulls back overgrown vines.
Flat-screened pieces. Just dumped.
Also piles of camcorders, keyboards, old lead-filled computer monitors.
More stuff they can't deal with.
Puckett believes that both of these operations are probably illegal. Hong Kong bans hazardous waste imports from developed nations, including the U.S. Overall, the tracking investigation found that 70 U.S. recyclers were involved in shipping e-waste to China, Thailand, Pakistan, Taiwan, Mexico, and Kenya. The computer with the GPS chip that led Puckett to this junkyard, it was dropped off last year at one of the most respected recycling programs in the U.S., Dell Reconnect, which has a strict no-export policy. So how did it find its way here? Dell says it wants to know, too.
If there's something that did not follow the system, we would certainly want to know about it, and we would certainly take corrective action.
That's Beth Johnson, who manages the Dell program. She says the company plans to investigate its downstream recycling partners. One thing we do know is that there's economic pressure these days to ship e-waste offshore. John Shigarian, who runs Electronics Recyclers International, the country's largest e-waste recycler, says prices for recovered materials have plummeted.
At the height of the market, when we would go to sell steel, plastic, gold, silver, palladium, copper, on an aggregated basis, we were getting 14 to 15 cents a pound more than we are today.
But labor costs are still higher here. So it's more profitable these days to ship old electronics overseas. And in most cases, it's not illegal. The U.S. is the only developed country that hasn't ratified the Basel Treaty on Hazardous Waste, and efforts to ban exports in Congress have failed. Europe, by contrast, has some of the toughest e-waste laws in the world. Among other things, EU governments tax manufacturers to subsidize domestic recycling. For his part, activist Jim Puckett says he's going to keep on pressing companies to do the right thing and live up to their promises. For The World, Ken Christensen, Hong Kong.
That story was co-produced by EarthFix's Katie Campbell. Let's go out today on a brassy note and look at what's coming up next week on The World. A conversation with Herb Alpert, trumpet player, studio exec, record producer. Oh yeah, the man who gave us the sound of the Tijuana Brass in the 60s. Herb Alpert's still at it. He's playing a two-week residency at the Cafe Carlyle in New York. And he loves what's happening in the global music scene today.
The YouTube of the world has, you know, kind of like brought it all together, where you can hear what's happening in remote spots and borrow a little bit from here and a little bit from there. You know, Stravinsky, the great classical composer, said, we don't borrow music from other composers. We steal.
That's honest.
Yeah.
More of my conversation with Herb Alpert next week on The World from the Nan and Bill Harris Studios at WGBH here in Boston. I'm Marco Werman. Back with you tomorrow.
PRI, Public Radio International.